Hi there, Dr. B here with your Module 1 clarifying lecture for EDSC 619. In these clarifying lectures, I'll do some announcements, we'll go over your assignments, and then I'll answer your questions. So let's talk a little bit about announcements. One of the things that I want to make sure that you understand is that every single instruction that's put into these assignments is there because it's very important. So make sure that you're reading everything carefully and not skimming. Use that assignment checklist and all of your instructions, and you should do just fine. For ABA sets, make sure that for your username, you're using lowercase gmu and the last four digits of your G number. That will get you into the ABA sets. Keep in mind that they do take some time to do, sometimes over several hours. So make sure you're allotting enough time to get them done because they are pretty intense. If you have any payment questions, make sure that you're contacting the Science of Behavior people directly. They can help you with the payment. I can't so much. Make sure that you're using the templates provided and that you're turning in Google Docs. Some of you are turning in Word docs and PDFs, and that's just going to slow down grading to you. So it's important that you use the Google Docs because that's the most efficient way to get stuff done. We've set this up so that it's most efficient so that we can get that feedback right back to you. And so what does it mean to get a 1 on an assignment? When you get a 1 on an assignment, that means that there's something that needs to be revised and resubmitted. So if you get a 1, you can always resubmit that for a higher grade. Usually it's because it's in the wrong format or I can't open it. So make sure that you are looking at those things carefully and submitting those assignments again. Nice job on your intro videos. I learned a lot about you. A lot of you are registered behavior technicians, so have some experience in the field. Some things to keep in mind are that we're not going to get into methods. So you're really not going to have tips and tricks or learn it today, use it tomorrow types of stuff that's going to happen here in this course. This is going to be about the basics of the science of behavior, not so much about therapy. So this is basically the why of why everything does what it does. And then the hows you'll get to later. I saw there was a question about a how. I'm going to skim over it a little bit because you'll be getting to that in later classes. Okay. And so it's important that you're thinking about this as science, that this is just like bio, just like chem, just like physics. It's a scientific approach to human behavior. So we're not really going to be doing any psychology here. And for people who are trained in clinical psych or maybe have a background in clinical psych, that can be a difficult transition. So what I want you to do, if that's you and you're having some trouble with this idea of explanatory fictions and all that stuff, stop by office hours. I'm happy to talk you through all of this kind of stuff. That's what office hours are for. I'd love to see you, even if you aren't having a problem. I often don't hear from the people who for things that things are going just fine for. So please stop in. Just say hello. So a couple of things to note. One of them is that I'm going to be really strict about terms. And one term that I'm going to be really strict about is that we don't say that people have behaviors. And so sometimes people use this as a euphemism, kind of like, you know, when you're having, you're on a plane and the pilot says, we're having weather right now. Well, I hope so, because if we're not having weather, we're in a vacuum, not good. So I want you to get away from saying that things that people are having behaviors. And I want you to really think about them as, you know, helpful or unhelpful behaviors. Instead, because our everything we do is behavior, and that's going to be really a central key to everything that we do in this course and beyond. Couple of things to note that I'm going to be very strict about too. I really take issue with the term ABA to describe a person. So a person is not an applied behavior analyst. You have to know everything. You have to know the philosophical and conceptual. You have to know the basic research. You can't just know the applied, because if you just know the applied, you're really doing your clients a disservice because you're not incorporating the entire science. So I want you to think about it this way. Would you go to a doctor who didn't think that anatomy and physiology was very important because they just wanted to start prescribing drugs and, you know, doing surgery? You would run for the hills, is my guess. And so think about this course as kind of like the anatomy and physiology, and we're going to get even deeper into that in 622, for what you're learning, that you got to get those basics down. Another thing, there is no such thing as behavioral analysis. It's behavior analysis. We're not analyzing behaviorally, we're analyzing behavior. So it's behavior analysis, not behavioral analysis. And this is often used to kind of be like a test to see if somebody is actually studied ABA or if they kind of have a surface knowledge. So it's a test of your credibility in some ways to say behavior analysis versus behavioral analysis. Let's get into the InterTeach now. In InterTeach, I'll be reviewing your collaboration and your videos starting in Module 2. I didn't do it this time for Module 1, but I will be doing it starting in Module 2 because I really want you to make sure that you are collaborating. So make sure you have that evidence. Make sure you're making those videos, those recordings, because I will be holding you to that. And you'll see again that as we learn the terms, I'm going to get more strict with those terms too. So this week I let a lot of things kind of slide because you're still learning. As you learn and grow, you're going to be held more accountable to those things. And the question about that is, why? Who cares? You know, reward versus reinforcer or whatever. There's two reasons. The first is that when you go to take the exam, when people pass the exam, I always ask them, what types of advice would you give to a brand new student? And almost always what I hear is be strict with the terms and be very fluent and know exactly what they mean. Because if you're not there with those, application becomes very, very difficult. So if you're still struggling with what positive reinforcement is or an explanatory fiction, for example, then when you have to go to use those things, or maybe you have to look at a explanatory fiction and or a behavioral concept and explain it in terms that a family would understand, you're going to get stuck. You're going to get it wrong. So it is very, 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 very important that we stay very strict and faithful to the terms. So I'm going to be strict with those. I'm really going to hammer them home. When talking about science, I want you to stay away from the term prove. And the reason is in this module and in Module 2, we're going to start talking about philosophic doubt when it comes to science. And in philosophic doubt, what we're saying is that we work with the evidence that we have available right now. And when new evidence shows up, we abandon the old evidence and we go with the new evidence. So nothing is ever truly proven, it's supported. And I think a good example of this is how the science is evolving with coronavirus. You know, we're told to do one thing, and then the science evolves very rapidly, and we notice that that one thing is not as good as this thing, so do this thing now. And some people think that that's wishy-washy. It actually is a hallmark of good science, because as we learn more, we change our ways. Okay, so that's why we never say science proves anything. And again, you know, science of behavior is a natural science. It is just the same. I want you not to think about this as much like psychology or therapy, as much as bio or chem or physics. You're really getting into a scientific analysis. So let's talk about behavioralism. So behaviorism. I just said behavioralism. Ooh, bad. Let's talk about behaviorism. So structuralism is really exactly what it's saying. What is the structure of the behavior? What are the thoughts? What are the things that are happening right now that make the behavior look the way it does? That is what structuralism really is. Methodological behaviorism is a little different. So we call thoughts, feelings, things that go on under the skin, private events. And so a methodological behaviorist is going to say private events have no place in the analysis of behavior. Can't see it, can't measure it, don't bother with it. People like Watson even went so far as to say that private events were a complete illusion and that they didn't exist, that there was no such thing as thoughts and feelings. Not everybody ascribes to that level, but that's basically what a methodological behaviorist is. A radical behaviorist, however, say that private events absolutely have a place. So thoughts, feelings, all those types of things, they're behavior, okay? We don't put them in a special category. They're not a special type of antecedent. They're none of those types of things. So if you see the, if you see like the memes, you know, your thoughts create your reality. No, not from a radical behavioral perspective. Your thoughts are behavior. Thoughts are your reality. The problem is that they're hard to study by other people because the only person who can really say what's going on in your head and observing it is you. And all of the other contingencies that make up you kind of bias the way that you would talk about those things. So while they're very important, they're absolutely behavior, they're absolutely a part of, you know, why we do what we do, and they are things that we do, they're not easily measured by other people. I have to make educated guesses about them, and in behavior analysis, we try to stay away from guessing. That's the difference between methodological and radical behaviorism. So let's talk a little bit about that one about behaviorism is created by logos. You see this all the time in memes, in blogs. A lot of times you'll see this used by anti-ABA people, and it's flat out incorrect. So I'm doing a presentation for the Open Educational Resources Special Interest Group of the Association for Behavior Analysis International, short-term OERSIG, on the 27th of this month. And so I've been really looking into the history of behavior analysis, both basic and applied. And there's an article by Ed Morris where he really says that there really is no one father of behaviorism or one inventor of applied behavior analysis. Rather, what it was is that it was the work of a group of people, sometimes several groups of people, that all came together to create our science. So it's not that there, and I really have an issue, and I'm growing to have more of an issue with it, with placing anybody on a pedestal, whether it's Skinner or Watson or Pavlov, because our science was founded by fallible people who did great things and also did pretty lousy things, just like everybody on the planet. So while I can respect their work, I really caution you to maybe not put Skinner on a pedestal, and not to look at what people say as necessarily infallible. Again, as we learn more science, we change our ways. Okay. So there really isn't necessarily a father of behaviorism. There's not necessarily a founder of ABA. There was a group of people who all came together, and all their work really influenced what we do right now. ABA also isn't a therapy, okay? And that's really, really, really important. It happens to be applied to some people in a therapeutic context, but ABA is designed to address socially significant issues. ABA, you know, there's people who are working on things like climate change. There are people in ABA who are working on things like homelessness, drug addiction. There are people in ABA who are working on, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So ABA is not a therapy. It's not a method. It's a science of over which we understand what people do, what they do. So why do people do what they do? And we identify a socially significant issue and we address it through that science. That's what ABA is. And the Bear, Wolf, and Risley article basically took all the work of all of these people and said, okay, you know, we kind of have to have a roadmap as to what ABA is and what it isn't. And so they put together this 1968 article that said, okay, this is what it is. This is all the work of all these people. This is what applied behavior analysis is. It's not a rule. It's not dogma. It's not any of those things. It's a framework under which we can say this stuff is behavior analytic, okay? As far as, let's talk, shift gears a little bit, talk about respondent versus operant learning. Respondent learning is the association between a stimulus and a response. So when you are doing pairing, for example, if you work with kids with autism where you establish, yourself as a reinforcing stimulus, you are engaging in respondent learning. I don't like the term conditioning because my mentors didn't like it either. They like learning better. So I like respondent learning rather than conditioning, but both are correct. Operant learning is where not only is there a relationship between a stimulus and a response, but there's also a third contingency, which is the reinforcer or the punisher. The reinforcer, or the process of reinforcement, so there's no such thing as reinforcements or punishments, either is going to increase behavior by introducing something into the environment or by taking something away. And again, here, we're going to talk about this again next week, but make sure that you're not looking at this from a happy, sad standpoint, positive being happy, negative being bad. Positive means to add and negative means to subtract. So you're either adding something or taking something away. If behavior increases, it's reinforcement. If it decreases, it's punishment. So those value judgments of good, bad, happy, sad, all this, sweep those away and look at what something does to behavior. So let's talk about why that then falls into why we don't use the term reward. So rewards are happy things that happen to people and make them happy. And that's not our job, okay? Our job is to increase or decrease responding. Reinforcement strengthens. And I'll talk about, you get a table at a flea market and it's really not sturdy. Are you going to paint it pink? Reward it with a pretty color? No. You're going to get 2x4s. You're going to, tighten the screws. You're going to reinforce its stability. And that's what reinforcement is. It's strengthening the stability of a response. So what is motivation? Motivation isn't drive, okay? It's not like wanting to or anything like that. What it is that reinforcing, again, strengthening that response. Now, what makes that reinforcer stronger or weaker? Motivating operations. So what affects the effectiveness of the reinforcer, basically, is what a motivating operation is. It has nothing to do with internal states or thinking or anything like that. We may talk that way to families because that's easier to understand. But you're at the level now where you need to start talking about it from a scientific standpoint, at least amongst us, okay? And so it's really important that you're thinking about it that way. Some quick things. We're going to keep talking about these as we go along across the semester. One is that thoughts are behaviors. Thoughts are reinforced too. Feelings are reinforced too. They are not necessary for reinforcement to have its effects. So you don't have to be, quote unquote, aware of reinforcement or cognizant of reinforcement or understand reinforcement. None of that is necessary nor sufficient. You don't need any of that. It's just a relationship between this stimulus that strengthens this behavior. That's all it is. Okay? You can have a complete and total non-understanding of it and it'll still work. So we want to stay away from mentalism. So thoughts, feelings, they all have a place. They're all behavior, they're reinforced, they're punished, all those types of things. However, we, as one person, can't crawl into the hat of somebody else to observe what their thoughts and feelings are. We're making educated guesses based on overt behaviors. So if I smile, I make the guess that I'm happy. If I smile like this, I make the guess that maybe that's a little fake. Maybe it may not be. We don't know. We can't crawl into somebody's head to know. We're making educated guesses. So rather than that, I'm going to say client smiled. I'm not going to say client is happy. Client is happy is more mentalistic. If I say, why is the client happy? Because they're smiling. Why are they smiling? Because they're happy. That's an explanatory fiction. So things like they're conscious of the reinforcer. We don't know. Okay. We're going to describe behaviors rather than try to put a label to them. Okay, that's the difference. And so we want to avoid mentalism. We want to avoid explanatory fictions. The way to do that is to describe what you see and not try to interpret it. So let's talk a little bit about reinforcement versus punitive strategies. So first off, remember that PBS, positive behavior support, doesn't mean happy behavior support. There is a kind of a faction of people that think that if someone's not happy, it's not positive. Remember, positive means to add. So we're talking about preventative teaching strategies that include reinforcement to strengthen appropriate responding. We're not talking about happy, okay? Why do we go to reinforcement strategies rather than punitive strategies? Well, a lot of you got from the book that punitive strategies do not teach a replacement response. So they're more suppressive in nature. And punitive strategies, they do suppress responding way faster. So, you know, if something needs to go away rather quick, a punitive strategy is very effective. But it also turns into kind of a whack-a-mole. Okay, so I get rid of this behavior, this one pops up, I go whack that one, and, you know, obviously I'm not hitting children, please, you know, I'm not advocating any type of corporal punishment or any type of aversive physical stimuli when I'm talking about this. Whack-a-mole is just an analogy. Whereas if I'm using reinforcement-based strategies, they take longer to have an effect, okay? It takes longer to teach them, takes longer to stick, but in the end, they're going to be a bit more durable, and they also teach something to do instead. So they're more efficient, they're more durable, but they take a little longer. So that, and there is room for reinforcement and punishment in our lives. It's all around us. We'll talk about that more as we go along in the semester. But, you know, there's nothing inherently good or bad versus reinforcement versus punishment. But reinforcement-based strategies tend to work a little bit better. They tend to be more socially acceptable. They tend to be more durable. All right, let's get to your questions. I didn't get a clear understanding of Lovaas's work in comparison to Skinner's, the similarities and differences. So I kind of talked a little bit about this earlier. So Lovaas was a guy, again, just a guy. And at that time, there were a bunch of people who were starting to look at this basic work that Skinner was doing. He had done some things here and there. People had done some things here and there, trying to figure out this, all this reinforcement and punishment stuff is great. It's shown in the lab. It's awesome. But so what? And so people were working on some of this stuff. And at the time, individuals who were, you know, diagnosed with autism were institutionalized. They were considered to be people who couldn't learn. And so a bunch of people got together and they said, well, you know, if everybody learns through reinforcement, let's see if this works for individuals who have been, you know, institutionalized and are, you know, basically in these really, really horrible conditions. let's see if we can teach them a few things and get them out of these horrible conditions. So they did, and it seemed to be effective. And so Lovaas took a lot of that information, expanded upon that, added to it, and created, you know, what we now know as early intensive behavioral intervention. So he took Skinner's work, and he also took the work of all these other people around him and put it together, manualized it, added the science that he had done, and created a more a comprehensive plan for individuals with autism. So, yes, he had a huge influence on what was going on, but he certainly wasn't the only guy. There are a lot of criticisms of what he did, but he was also starting with a very, very, very young science in a different era. So a lot of things that we know today were not the same back then. And I'll be getting into that in my presentation if you ever want to see it, or I'll post the link to it. And again, just a guy makes mistakes. So there were mistakes early on. There are mistakes. There are probably mistakes going on today that, you know, 20 years from now, you'll go, I can't believe I did that. So while very influential, just a real piece of all the things that were going on during that time. How do structuralists measure behavior objectively and quantify behavior causes by unobservable factors? They don't. So what you would do is that you would observe this one behavior. So, you know, I'm smiling. Say that's happiness. That happiness causes me to skip. Okay. That is basically what a cognitivist would do. And that's what we try to avoid in behavior analysis. The readings and videos discuss at length the negative potential of using punitive strategies to influence behavior. Talk about evidence-based practices. Yes, we always use science. Describe the client as engaging in self-injurious and aggressive behaviors following punishment. And describe some sort of neutrality when reinforcing strategies are used. Can you discuss the benefits of reinforcement itself rather than as superior alternative to punishment? Yes, but that's going to take all semester. You will be learning way more about this in 619 and 622. So while yes, I can, it would take me all day. So I want you to hold that question. And if you still have that same question at the end of 622, come find me. Because yes, you're right. There is no good or bad. It's not that reinforcement is great and punishment is bad. It's that reinforcement has more socially acceptable things as opposed to punishment, which is a little less socially acceptable. The texts describe applied behavior analysis as improving lives through behavioral change through socially significant factors. Yes. While it makes great strides in getting people to engage in pro-social and socially acceptable behaviors, how can we use the science, if at all, to impact individually significant changes, such as shaping a self-injurious stereotypy, I don't use the term STEM, to a neutral stereotypy, excuse me, that does not impact negatively the individual or those around them. Here, too, I want you to hold that thought, because you're going to have a whole class in that. EDSC 623 is all of that. So what I want you to do with that question, hold a thought. I want you to really learn these basics cold, okay? 619, 622, and when you get to 623, that's when you're going to actually start to apply this to those socially significant behaviors, 623, 24, 25, okay? So that's very important that you do that through and that you start looking at the basics first. Build on the basics. So I'm not blowing you off on those. I'm just saying that we're going to get to those later. And again, if you don't get those questions answered by the end of 623, come find me. All right. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it and have a great day.